This is the Emotional Horsemanship Podcast. I am Lockie Phillips, your host. Emotional horsemanship coaches deeply caring horse people to train emotionally balanced horses with science, empathy, and feel. And this is the podcast dedicated to exploring all of that within. We try to innovate horse training that puts the horse first. Season 2 of this podcast brings us solo episodes, special guests, and small groups of guests as we discuss horses, horse training, the equestrian industry, and the big, big, beautiful ideas that horses inspire in us always. Your guest on the podcast today is hoof care legend Ida Hammer. Ida Hammer is the founder of the Mackinaw Dells 2 Whole Horse Hoof Care Certification Program based in Illinois, with training programs and opportunities throughout the US. Ida Hammer has been a pioneer in the holistic hoof care movement, primarily the barefoot hoof care movement, and really is an authority on healthy hooves and the holistic elements that have to go into building up healthy hooves. I feel very, very fortunate that Ida agreed to join me on the podcast and was so generous to share her time and her expertise and her generosity with us. I really enjoyed the conversation and I'm so, so happy to present her here to you. I hope you enjoy. Ida Hammer, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. How are you today?
Good. Good.
Thank you for being here and making this time to speak with me today and to have us all hear you today. I'm very grateful to have you.
Grateful to be here. I've been looking forward to this for quite a while.
Oh, great. Well, listen, I've heard a rumor that maybe sometimes you do something with hooves.
I live, breathe, and drink them.
So, Ida Hammer, who are you? What do you do?
So,
and how do you do it?
Do you want me to go from the long beginning, or do you want
you
to just
you can do? And in the beginning, there was light. You can start there if necessary.
Well, I've had horses since I was a little kid.
Yeah.
So, I tell people at the class, you can tell that it's been a long time just by the color of my hair. So,
no.
Yes.
No.
I've had horses since I was 5, and we've done every kind of thing with horses, and we've been, that's the whole traditional thing. It's like, so there's all these learning curves for everything. And so we did a lot of stuff that we never went to the crazy side of doing crazy things, but stuff that I would still not ever do now. But we did the traditional things with like the metal shoes on the horses and we didn't really have a reason why. It's like, it's just what people did. So that's what we did. And so, we had racing quarter horses. I jockeyed for a while. We did all kinds of sports, just competitive trail riding was my favorite actually, because it was the one sport that really you can't cheat. Mm. And everybody else, my people in my classes know I pick on every modality of showing. It's like discipline, every act, every discipline. That's the word I was looking for.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, because it's like they all want to win at the expense of the horse. And so there's all that. And so I'll fast forward I won't go from birth to when I was a teenager. we've had all this stuff that we've done with horses for my whole life. But then when you fast forward to the 80s, my spouse and I bought our first cutting bred horse, and we were pretty excited. And at the time, we asked, who is the best cutting trainer that we could send her to? And so when you ask for best, this life is a learning curve. It's like all of life is a learning curve. So it's like when you ask for best, what are they the best at? Are they the best at winning? Are they the best at caring about your horse? Are they best about doing the right things? What are they best at? And so he came highly recommended as the best, but he was the best at winning, which is automatically a problem. So I'll preface that with saying, though, when we bought her, our little cutting horse, she was raised on pasture and whole corn. And so then we took her straight to the trainer, who is 6'3" and she's 14'1", as a 4-year-old, I'm like, so many bad things. So I'm like, so I tell my students, like, to, from the get go, like when we're talking about stuff not to do, or like this is why you shouldn't do something, I'm not judging anyone because I've already done it. And so it's like, I'm just trying to save them the heartache of doing it. So we got her and sent her to the best trainer, and she was very talented. And so he rode her a lot. Well, when she came back, she was intermittently lame. And so, and Ada worked for the vet at the time. And he said, well, this is your $1 million horse because she has navicular disease. And like, she's between 4 and 5 then. And we're like, okay. And so we did every single thing that we were told to do with her: hard bar shoes and isoxaprin and, you know, like wedge pads. I'm like, the wedge pads have got to be ridiculous, because it's like you use one wedge pad for a while and then it's another wedge pad, and then it's just ridiculous. And she never really got any better. She just, like, we had a buter to shoe her, a buter to do anything. So it just, she was not miserable. Like, we had to put her down miserable, but she was not a sound horse. So everybody also knows that Ada always buys pretty. So she wanted to get another horse, and she had to be a blue roan. Didn't matter if it's sound or sane, it just had to be pretty. So we went and we found and this is fast forward, like, several years after Seeker was diagnosed with her navicular disease. So fast forward to that. And so we took her a little spin in the arena. Like, I took her for a little spin in the arena, and she was, you know, she was fine, like, just for a little arena ride. And then we went out to go on a trail ride, and we didn't do a vet check because, you know, see, she was pretty and all the wrong things. So we went to go on our first trail ride. We had him tied up, and well, she pulls back like a wild horse. Like, she pulled back and was throwing herself on the ground and making bucking noises and groaning noises. And so Ada said, well, she's like, I think you can have her and I'll take your horse. And I said, okay. So we did that, and we switched, and she's a really rangy mare. I'm like, we still have her. She's amazing. But so, like, through my whole life of transitioning with horses, you know, we went with, like, traditional stuff, traditional training, all that stuff. So then we moved up to where, like, okay, we're going to take her to the Pirelli Center for a week in Florida. So we went to do some natural horsemanship. We went down there, and preface it with saying, first, I'm like, it was two 12-hour days to drive down there. And of course, she had metal shoes on because we're going to ride on sand. So, like, you know, that's a necessity, not. So we did that. And then I also will preface it with saying that she was on the worst diet you could possibly give a horse, because, again, it's like, traditionally, like, from where I came up from, it's like, we do lots of molasses, lots of corn, lots of oats. And I will say, just one tiny bit in my defense, in the 70s, I took horse nutrition classes, and the three main staples were oats, corn, and barley.
You're kidding.
No, it's like, it was like, I'm like, I was all cocky proud, you know, it's like, I've got this diet, like, and I made them the best diet they loved, you know, it's like, they got molasses.
Sugar.
Yeah. Lots of, and pure alfalfa hay. So it's like, that's what they got. So when we went to Florida, and we spent a lot of intense days working. And we came back, and she was lame. So it's like, okay, I'm going to give her just a little bit. Maybe it's a trip or something like that. So we went to, like, about a week later, like, she was still pretty lame. So we went to the University of Illinois to have her checked to see what's wrong. And she has a scar on her left hip. It's a pretty significant scar. She's had that since we've had her. And she was palpating all kinds of sore on that scar, but they really zeroed in on her right front foot and wanted to x-ray it. So when they x-rayed it, she does have a huge navicular bone spur on her navicular bone. And so they started right in with their speech right away. I'm like, because she was only like 6 going on 7. So they started another speech right away. You know, this horse, you know, you're going to need to put her in wedge pads and heart bar shoes and isoxaprin. And really, we suggest doing a neurectomy because, like, she's really not going to, like, she's going to not make it for very long. I'm like, she'll never make it to be a teenager. And so Ada's like, we spent our first $1 million on the first horse. So, like, either, like, find a better way, put her to sleep now, or get rid of her. Well, I joke with everybody here, it's like, our place is like Hotel California. Horses come, but they never leave. You know, so they're just, she's not going anywhere. So I had talked to my instructor that was down there, and she kind of got me connected with Pete Ramey. And then I actually went through the AA and HCP first.
And which year did you get connected with Pete Ramey?
That was in 2004.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So I started with that group because Pete was in Jamie's group at the same time, the AA and HCP. And so I started learning like from them and the Mustang Trim and stuff. And it was
from Pete and Jamie at the same time.
Yes, because wow. Pete was still there. Like Pete and I are still friends, but like he doesn't travel much. Like he doesn't travel at all, as far as I know now. Because I just talked to him last summer, and he said he's just enjoying living life and playing with his kids. So, and his grandkids now. We were in that together, and then some stuff happened within the group that, you know, there was Jamie wanted us to sign a contract and stuff that would trim the horses the same, like we had specifics that we'd trim to. And so fact of the matter is like anybody that knows me is I really don't like rules. Mm. Like I really don't like rules. But that's pretty much it. It's like, unless there's a safety rule or something. But so I'm like, there's no way I'm ever signing a paper that I would do the same thing to every horse ever. So there's a lot of people that left, and Pete started the American Hoof Association then. And so I went with him. A lot of people left, some stayed and did what they were told. And there was a lot of lame horses going on, and some, stayed and didn't do what they were told. It just said they just signed the contract. And I'm like, I'm not going to do that either, because I'm not going to be dishonest about what I'm doing. I go off on this on a regular basis in my classes and stuff. There's no such thing as one trim fits all, or there's no such thing as everything is the same on any living creature. Like there isn't. So went off with the American Hoof Association with them. And I taught trimming for the AA and HCP and anatomy classes for them while I was there also. And then just kind of like you about your horse owner classes, when I started doing that, I was teaching the professionals at the AA. I'm not getting my talking too fast and getting my letters all blobbed
A,
up.
But A.
NHCP.
NHCP. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So so I thought, well, when I quit training people to trim, like there's a huge gap. Because a lot of the people that came to learn how to trim they started off as horse owners that wanted to trim their own horses, but they fell in love with it. So there's a huge gap. So I just started teaching horse owners. I was just doing horse owner classes. And then what would happen is that when I was doing that, a lot of the horse owners, like they fell in love with it. And then they helped their friends' horses, and then they helped their friends' horses. And so then they're like, well, can we start learning more stuff? So then I started turning it into a certification program. And the certification program that I have is a certification of completion, because I don't like the idea of giving a certification for somebody to have like a blanket cover.
To be a professional.
Yeah. I have a lot of professionals, but the certificate for me means it's a certificate of completion. Like, and we have all kinds of continuing ed. And what they do with it, then they're still certified. I have certified trimmers, and then I have certified non-trimming fellows, which like body workers, they want to understand the feet, but they don't really want to trim the feet. But I have over 215, I probably have 275 graduates throughout the U.S. I have one in the U.K. and we're hoping to get, we're in the middle of getting started in South Africa. It's getting a group over there. So I have lots of professional trimmers, but the continuing education part is up to them. And we have a private group of 215 of the graduates, and that we confer all the time on. It's a safe place for us to ask questions, Mike, that we have the newest of graduates and the seniorest of graduates, and they're all on there to be able to ask questions and get advice and anything like that. So, because on that group, I don't allow any arguing, negativity, backbiting, or sharing any information outside of that group, because it needs to be a safe place for them to be able to ask questions and not feel silly.
Nice.
So so it started off just being, you know, for the horse owners when I left the AA and HCP. But it quickly got to be a certification program. And then I just keep adding classes. And then I have elective classes also so that they can keep growing. And one of the things, so many of the trimming schools or teachers or however you want to put it, like so many of them, and even the first group, because Jamie, that's the whole thing with the contract, you know, he wanted all the horses trimmed the same. And so many of the instructors want clones of themselves. And I'm like, and I do not want clones of me. I want my people to be better than me. So, you know, that's a lot of gibberish for like, maybe I answered way too much more than I needed to. I don't know. But so right now, currently, I have a certification program. I have, like I said, about 250 graduates. I have in close connection with 215 of them. I'm like, we talk regularly. I know their work. I'm like, I can see a foot trimmed and know who trimmed it. That we do, usually we have two advanced professional classes a year. That's what I was hoping to get you to, maybe next, like, I know this year is full, but maybe next year, like for, as a guest, but, we just, on those classes, it's for graduates only. And we just kind of nerd out the whole time. I'm like, well, whatever they want to do, we do. So we'll do experiments with hooves. I'm like, we'll have guest speakers. Like one year we did bread slices of the foot so we could actually see the digital cushion. There's actually micro ligaments inside the digital cushion. So we bread sliced those and put them under lights. We put computer chips on horses' feet to see how many milliseconds we could get their cadence. Like one of them had a torn, patellar ligament. And so we just did some creative things to see, what we could do to make that horse his most comfortable self and still keep healing. Even better, just stuff like that. Like, and I'm biased, but I think I'm biased for a reason, but I'm like, the people that are in our group are the most progressive. They're just the most progressive, awesome horse people. I'm like, almost all of them follow this kind of stuff. They're like, I've encouraged them. Like I went to, Sharon May Davis whole horse dissection in 2023, I've encouraged my students to do that too. And so like many of them have done that, like, they never stop learning and, you know, so there's just, I just have the best job in the world.
Well, if you want to bring me over, count me in. Cause that sounds like a party that I want to join. Fun.
Oh, it's so much fun. I'm like, we just do experiments. It's like, cause there's really like the only rules, these are the only rules I have. It's like for rules. It's like, you have to be safe. You and the horse have to be safe. You have to have fun and no negativity. I'm like, if we can get along with all that, then that's the only rules we have, because we just like whatever, like, and we start making plans now as far as like, what do you want to do? You know, what kind of experiments you want to do? So like, we'll just do, like we did experiments on, we took some cadaver legs and soaked them overnight in water and a thin sole, average sole, a thick sole. And like, and we could tell just like by overnight soaking their feet, how much it softened the sole to where you could actually almost penetrate the coffin bone. Mm-hmm. So just different, like whatever that you want to experiment. One time we had Wendy Murdoch was our guest and we learned how to do Feldenkrais on each other first so that we can feel what that felt like for the horses. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, you definitely like we need a 2026 have you.
I'd love to. Well, you're a legend.
That's funny.
But also self-deprecating, which most legends are.
Well, I don't know what to say.
I know, I have a complicated relationship to compliments also. That's usually my party line. I say I have a complicated relationship to compliments. Thank you so much. And then we keep talking about something else. Let's dive into something nitty-gritty hoof-related or hoof care work-related. Which one do you want to talk about first, Ida? Do you want to talk about hooves or do you want to talk about the work of working on hooves first?
Whichever you want to do. Usually my motto is help, I'm talking and I can't shut up. So like,
well, that's the point of a podcast. That's the point of a podcast.
You just direct me what to say. Or okay. What do you want to talk about?
Let me start with this before we get to hooves, because I spent a short but meaningful period of my professional life trimming for the public locally in the south of Spain. So desert environment, rock hard hooves, and all of that goes with it. And usually atrocious horse keeping. I say atrocious because I just interviewed a Spanish vet and that was what she said. She said atrocious horse keeping. And I went, your words, thank you. I'll borrow them. So a lot of problematic hooves, often unhandled horses, or horses in remote locations with long trim cycles, very robust conditions. It was a short and meaningful period, and I basically dipped my toe in to that field and went, "Oh, can't handle that heat. I'm getting out of that kitchen." So I got out of that kitchen, and then I focused on teaching owners to trim. My way of saying, "Well, how do you like it?" "Well, how do you like it? Criticize your farrier again. Come here, spend 3 months learning to trim, and then tell me if you'll ever criticize your trimmer or your farrier ever again." It's extremely difficult, extremely difficult. But also more, I'm being facetious, of course, but more importantly, to really equip owners with what is kind of the last frontier in horse ownership and stewardship of horses. People, even people who know something about saddle fit or something about bridle fit or something about training, often don't know nothing about what happens below the pastance.
Mm-hmm.
And even if they don't trim their own horses, it behooves them, pun intended. It's my favorite pun. I use it at least 3 times a day. It behooves them to know what's going on. At least for no other reason than if you're riding around and your horse feels off on the left hind and you pick up the foot and you're like, "Oh, there's some overlaid bar. I can fix that." You fix it, get back on, the horse goes well again. You can fix it on the spot, you know, tinker with these things. But I got into it, and the thing that confused me the most, Ida, and I wonder if you want to speak to it in a positive manner, is the infighting inside the hoof care community. Farriers against trimmers, one school of trimming against another school of trimming, this professional against that professional, this concept against that concept. I found it really exhausting. I found it a waste of time. I found it really dangerous and uncomfortable. And you're a positive person, so let's keep it light. But I wonder if you might just comment or speak to that for a moment as a legend in hoof care yourself.
That still makes me laugh every time you say that.
You can laugh. I'll keep using it to keep making you laugh.
First off, it's like, I'm going to back up just a couple seconds here. Yeah. When I first started trimming, it was really, really a male dominated, like I got all this kind of stuff is like, "Oh yeah, it's a fad. It's going to pass." And it's like, and you know, I'm like, and for the most part, like I didn't have any problems, but I've had, you know, in the very beginning, I had some like, exhibits at horse fairs and stuff. And I'd have farriers come up, you know, that they've been trimming for a long time, and they would try to intimidate me and stuff. And the one, we end up becoming friends because he came up the very first year. I had Pete's book up on the table and he came by and ate of a man in the table at the time. And I just was going to get something to eat. And he came up and he grabbed that book and he's like a big guy and he's real boisterous. And he tossed the book down and he said, "See this book, I don't believe anything in it." And Ada goes, "Ida." And so I just came back and
Sorry. Your spouse's name is Ada and you're Ida.
Yes.
That is the best thing I've ever heard in my life.
It is. It's the best thing all the way around.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep.
Bless you both.
Well, that's
the best thing ever.
It is. When we got married, they called us, like, we now pronounce you the does.
Love it. Love it. That is so fantastic. Yes.
So he came, he's trying to be intimidating. He was like, it was a real new thing for, first of all, natural hoof care.
Mm.
And second of all, to be a woman in it, it's like when it's male dominated at that point, male dominated. And so I come around the corner and he did the same thing with me. He has his hands on his hips and he's got his boistery voice. And he's like, this book. And he tossed it on the table again for drama, I guess, or effect.
Emphatic emphasis.
Yes. And he said, "I don't believe a thing in it." And I said, I picked up the book and I said, "Well, you pick anything out of this book and tell me what you don't believe and I'll tell you why it's so." And he slapped his leg on his hand. He goes, "We're going to be friends."
Yeah.
I wouldn't back down from it. It's like, Like, you can intimidate all the people you want to, but like, I'm sorry, buddy, I'm a lot shorter than you. And I'm like, I can reach places you're going to be sorry if I even swing at you. So, you know, and he did, he goes, actually, what I want to do is see if I could come ride along with you for a little bit, because I have a client that wants me to learn how to trim like this. I said, I'd be happy to. So I'm like, he came, because I'm happy with that stuff. It's like, so I don't like all the backbiting. That's like with even in our group, I'm like, there is no backbiting or anything like that. So, and it could have went two ways. I'm like, he could have been there trying to intimidate me, and I could have like got defensive and just dismissed him and stuff. But then he wouldn't have learned how to, like, and he's still like, he's a 35-year-old veteran, like horseshoer. So he still did what he did. But what he said was that, he wanted to be able to do that for his client because she had asked him to learn how to do that kind of trim for her horses. And for him to be, you know, that seasoned and to be open enough to do that, old school guy, I'm like, I thought that was pretty impressive. So, so I don't really like the us versus them in any way, shape or form. Like, I've had horseshoers that I've many horseshoers, like nail on horseshoe people come through my classes. No problems. It's like, and I different trimming schools. I find that the trimming schools that have the biggest problem with all this rhetoric or whatever you want to call it is that they want everything to be just like theirs. Like, and there is in hoof care or horses, period, there is no just like anything. It's like it all is an individual thing. So you have to be. And you have to be okay with being wrong. It's like, that's one of the first things I will tell my students. It's like, you know, like, it's an uncomfortable feeling and I hate it, but you have to get used to being wrong. Because if you're not okay with being wrong, you're never going to learn anything. You're going to be stuck in your ways. And so that happens with a lot of training schools or training, like who's ever doing the teaching. You know, they don't want to ever be wrong. And if my student finds something that they're doing better than I am and they show me, I'm like, I'm happy to be like, whether it be wrong or improved, however you want to look at it. If I'm just doing it wrong, I'd want to know it. And if it's improved, I'm like, my students teach me things all the time and I'm happy with that. So I think that's the biggest problem really, is that people don't want to be wrong and they don't want to be, they want people to do things just like them. And I really don't want people to do things just like me. Mm. I want people to do things. I want them to have a basic, they need to have a basic knowledge, and then the horse dictates the rest of it. Mm. And black and white people want a paint by number.
Mm-hmm.
So, did that answer your question?
It did answer the question. This is the way I feel about it and the way I see it today at this time of day, but ask me in 10 minutes and I might change my mind. Right now, in this moment, I think an us versus them mentality is helpful only when what you're discussing is fresh off the press, only when what you're discussing has never been discussed before, only when what you're discussing is cutting edge, innovative, and rocking the boat by the nature of its information. Not the behavior of the information or the style of delivery, but by the nature of the information, it rocks the boat, such as iron peripheral loading devices will incur down the line potentially egregious health ramifications for the distal limb of the equine. When that first birthed into the industry as an awareness, by the nature of that information, it rocks the boat. And in that instance, the community at large, in my view, is not yet ready for emotional balance. We're not yet ready for reason. We're not yet ready for nuance, because what we're trying to do is lay some ground rules first. We're trying to understand yes and no before we look at maybes. We're trying to understand black and white before we look at the maybes. And you have to lay that first before you go to the nuance, because if you're going straight to nuance without foundations, you build a house of cards that comes crumbling down on you. And so any credible information, when it first tiptoes into the industry, will rock the boat and will cause division. try and show me anything in human history where traditional practices were changed and nobody's feelings were hurt. It never happened. It never happened. And so we shouldn't expect that from ourselves. And as kind, gentle folk, we can't put pressure on ourselves to be perfect around new information. But the minute the information isn't new anymore, what we're supposed to do is pump our brakes, put our feelings on the shelf, be aware of how we feel about this, but then look at the information and understand the nuance of the ramifications of this information and then integrate it straight away. That's the way I see it right now.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. It's like, because in two sorts of ways. It's like, first, you know, because again, it has to be, you have to accept something different than what you're used to. And so, and I'm a pretty big bullhead. So like, I don't trust anything until I research it to death, whether like, and I will research, it doesn't make any difference what it is. It's like, I will research whatever I need to research till I'm convinced, at least convinced one way or the other, until I have better or different information. Mm-hmm. So I am like that too. But I guess my us versus them part that about that is there's always going to be an us versus them, but there can be an us versus them in a good way and an us versus them in a bad way. Mm-hmm. And the us versus them in the good way is that, like, okay, so just the whole scenario that you just spoke of. So, you know, like we used to, like I said before, Michael, we did all the wrong things. So we used to use metal horseshoes, peripheral loading devices, and open heeled and all that stuff. And so now we know that's not a good thing to do. I'm like, and it makes sense. I'm like, and that was one of the first things I learned early on in the training that I had. But I never, at that point, I never badgered anyone into making a change. I would give them pieces of information about what could be better. So it doesn't have to be an us versus them like that. I'm like, there's always going to be that division of new knowledge versus old knowledge. And is the new knowledge any good, or is it just, you know, a fleeting passing thing?
Right.
So I think I agree with you with the there's always going to be that anytime we have new information, there's going to be a division of what we knew and what we don't know. But what people do with it is what I just don't think. I think unless it's causing like a disaster, so unless it's something that's causing a disastrous harm, I think that there are better ways than us versus them. It could be like differences of opinion, let's discuss. You know, does that make sense?
It does make sense. And again, I don't disagree with you. I also think there's space for all kinds of voices. Human society is a village for a reason. And some of the most advanced sociologists have argued that even sociopaths have a function in society, you know, which is a hard thing to understand. But everyone from scientists to artists have understood that all viewpoints and all voices are needed in times of change, even the voices that perhaps have room for improvement in regards to respect for others and kindness for others. We still need those voices. And I get them. They show up on my social media and they say this and they say that against my information. And often it's ad hominem attack. And often they've just gone outside of themselves, haven't made their position clear, and they'll come to me just to bring me down. And I don't do that to other people. I talk plenty of smack on my own channel, but I don't go outside of my own platform to do it. I do it from my environment. If people want to come to me to talk to me, it's different, or I invite people. But I understand that that crappy commenter is still a human being. And as much as I grit my teeth and hate to say it, their voice is needed too. You know, because there are some people who won't listen to anything else except the harshest of voices. Some people just won't listen to anything else except the most strident and aggressive voice.
Yep. Yep. I agree. Because, and sometimes, those guys will, those type of personalities will get the ball rolling for
right.
a better way to put it.
That's
so,
right.
Mike, I feel the same way. It's like, first of all, it's like, you know, I've had people, like, especially in the beginning, you know, they would get to, I'd post a, maybe an advertisement for class or something, and they would, and that back then, it was usually like a lot of the guy farriers yet still. And they'd be like, oh, my good, you know, like they know nothing about me, but they're like saying that, good, they can mess up all the horses, so we'll have more business and stuff. And so, but I just responded to him. I'm like, you know what? I'm like, I don't know you. So if you do really that good of a job, I'm like really excited for the horses in your care. I said, but I'm like, if you don't do that good of a job, then I'm really sorry for the horses in your care. So it's like, but since I don't know you, nor do you know me, maybe we could just agree to disagree.
Classy. But, I'll call that class. You're a class act, Ida Hammer.
I'm a smart ass.
Well, smart ass sees smart ass. It takes one to know another. So yeah, let's put that on the shelf. Enough of talking about that. Let's talk about hooves. You spoke a little earlier about people needing to know the basics, and then from there we can explore. If you had to explain day 1.1 in a few dot points or less, that's the hardest thing ever to synthesize. The basics of the healthy foot.
So the basics of the healthy foot. I would say in a nutshell, to have a healthy foot in a perfect world, because I'm like, there are some imperfections in our world, but to have a healthy foot, first, like, you have to treat diet. You have to, so I'm going to say diet, trim, environment, spirit, and teeth. It has to be whole horse. So like, so for my trimming classes, it's like, it's always whole horse. So whole horse means whole horse. And, you know, you have to treat the diet's always, diet isn't always the first thing. And so talk about, I'm going to digress for just a second, because I think this is funny because I lived through it. But, you know, I told you about how terrible our diet was with our horses. And the first class I went to, it was in New York. I went to class with Pete. It was, you know, it was the whole beginning thing. And the first thing, one of the first things he said was, like, all sweet feed needs to have a warning label on it, you know, like they do for cigarettes. And I truly was not being a smart aleck like then. I was just like, is that bad? Is that a bad thing? Cause it's like, I didn't know. So, then they explained it. And so I'm like, and it was a long day and it was a lot of information. So I went back to the hotel and Ada goes, how was class? And I said, it was great, but horrible. And she goes, what does that mean? I said, well, I learned a lot, but mostly what I learned is we're doing everything wrong.
Damn.
It's like, we're feeding wrong. Like, we're feeding the horses wrong. I'm like, we're keeping them wrong. We're doing everything wrong. And so, so diet sticks out in my mind the most because that is like the, because out of all the things that we were doing wrong, and we were doing several things wrong. But after I went through my first round of mentorships, in the group that I started with, both of our navicular horses were sound within two trims. But when I say that, they were sound within two trims, but it wasn't the magical trim that made them sound. I'm like, the trim was definitely better. I'm like, the long toes were gone, all the leverage is off, but it was the diet. The inflammation was gone because they were not getting an inflammatory diet anymore. So I was like, diet has to be first, because you can't trim a good foot onto a horse that has a really crappy diet. Mm-hmm. You can't trim a good foot onto a horse that's stuck in a stall 24/7 because they don't ever get any movement or circulation or anything. You can't get a good foot on a horse that's sad. You can't get a good foot on a horse that's body's all screwed up. You can't get a good foot on a horse that's teeth are screwed up. And there's just all of it. It's like every single thing, to the point that, sidetracking a little bit, but still the same. But I had one of my graduates, she had one of her metabolic horses foundered on her. And she was treating it, and she would getting him almost, she'd get him almost where he was 100% rehabbed, but he would just digress just a tiny bit. And then just kept happening like that. So she went and she thought outside of the box. And so she decided that she was going to move him, because where he was at, he was with other horses, but he didn't have friends. They weren't friendly. And so she moved him into a herd that he had friends. And that was the last piece. Like his feet finished healing completely. Like they're like normal feet. So that's a hard thing for old timers to put that piece into it. But it's like, if you're depressed, I'm like, you're not at your best health either. So horses get depressed and all the same thing. So it's the whole thing. It's the diet, it's the movement, it's the exercise, it's the environment, it's their friends, it's their psyche, it's their spirits, like it's everything. So that puts it in the trim. So, and oddly enough, I'm a trimmer, but the trim is important for sure, but it's the least important out of all of it.
Oh, 100%. I mean, in my course for owner trimmers, I say, generously say, trim is only 20% of the picture. And that's generously said. And before I teach that trim, or the two different trims I teach in that course, such as it is lifestyle, pathology, anatomy, alternative protection devices and strategies that aren't a peripheral iron loading device. And I couldn't help but sneak into there some of the ethics around training as well and how important that is. Because, for example, I remember when I learned how to ride a barefoot horse, especially on a trail, especially on a challenging trail, that you can't tell them where to go, how to go there so precisely that they can't insert their own direction. They can't insert their own adjustments. A barefoot horse has to be given at least a modicum percentage, if not the vast majority percentage, if not all of the percentage, to pick their way through this world and put their feet where the feet need to go. And with a shod horse, you can just kind of plow through anything, generally speaking, if they're sound in the shoes, which that's a whole other can of worms. Let's, okay. But you know what I mean? That's relative to the statement. But a barefoot horse is not unsound if they avoid or choose not to step on that rock over there. It means they're fully embodied and connected to their environment, and they're making judicious decisions about how to use their body as they go throughout the environment. And that actually denotes that they have a level of care and intent to keep you up there in a good way if they are picking their way through. And for people who are being told to boss up and push horses through, that's I might as well be speaking Klingon sometimes.
I agree. It's better now, but in the very beginning, like,
it was a challenge.
Yes, because you try to tell somebody, you know, you have to give them time, let them do this and that. And in the beginning, we didn't have a lot of options for hoof protection either.
Right.
So we didn't have a couple, but now there's really no reason why, like, there's no reason why anybody has to do anything that harm feet now, because
yes,
no matter what they're wanting to do. But in the beginning, people, and I still have some people, will not my clients now, because I've kind of weeded them out, but they would still insist that, well, they'll just have to suck it up. And I'm like, no, they don't.
No.
But it's like, and I'm like, why would you suck it up? And then they can't answer that. And they're like, then they try to, like, well, they're a horse. And I'm like, yeah, they're a horse, which means they're more sensitive because they can feel a fly before it even lands on them. Mm. So anyways, but.
Beautiful. I have a couple of, like, more technical questions, if I can run them past you for my own interest. Do you see place in modern 21st century hoof care going forwards for the iron shoe to still be part of the repertoire in extreme circumstances, or in those small percentages where everything else has failed, or that it has a function sometimes? Do you still see a place for the iron shoe?
I do.
You do?
I do. I'm like, so, and I tell my students this too. I'm like, so anything that I'm telling you, I'm like, this is what I tell them in class, but it's a dangerous thing to say always or never.
Mm-hmm.
And so I prefer not to do that. There's less likelihood of need for a metal shoe now, but mm-hmm. I can give you one example, like, for sure that I would prefer a metal shoe. And, this is a true story that happened. So it was like, I just had a lady that was going through my classes. She'd been trimming her own horses, but she's going through my classes, and she graduated And it was shortly after she graduated, her horse, like she pulled up in the pasture and her horse had cut its hoof almost in half. Like it cut the bone and everything. And so I don't know how she got it on the trailer, but she did get it to the vet. And she figured that it was just going to be euthanized because I'm like, it was laid open. So, you know, the vet was pretty creative and he told her, he said, just go find something to do for a while. I got to clean up this mess and see what we can do. And so he actually got the foot put back together. And when they got it put back together, first it started off in a cast. And then after it was coming out of the cast, I'm like, she called, she was really upset because, you know, because I'm not against metal shoes. I just don't think that we need them. We rarely need them anymore. But she's like, she was all upset. She's like, he's going to nail a shoe on him. And I said, that's good. He needs to have a shoe nailed on because it has to be something strong enough to keep the hoof together.
Right.
Because there are times that, like most, the majority of the time in a healthy, happy foot, we want the expansion and we want the ability to expand and contract. But in a case like that, we do not want to have that to expand and contract. I want it stable and steady. And so, and they had a really good farrier that could, he handmade the shoe so that it actually took out the part where that got cut out and didn't put any pressure on it. So
wow.
For a year and like in the horse, like it's a mounted shooting horse. So it's like that horse, like after a year, I'm like, the vet wanted her to keep the shoe on it forever. And she's like, so she had me look at it too. And she's like, I don't see why we'd need to have to do that. Do you? I said, no, I said the healing part's like over. I'm like, if she goes backwards at all with the composite shoe, then you'll have to revisit the metal shoe. But the actual stabilization of it was what we needed to do. And so when people start saying always or never, then something extremists are dangerous. I'm like, the horse will lose. So, yeah, there's a place for it.
A very extreme example, though.
Yeah. Yeah, there's not. So, I think this is...
We're going to take a break. Listening to this podcast free to air, and it is such an honor to present these episodes to anyone who has the time or desire to listen to them. It took me several years to have the ability to have a podcast because for a number of years I simply didn't have the time or the luxury. Even today, I edit and publish these episodes using my personal time to do so. And listen, I'm not complaining because this is a really, really wonderful way to spend my free time. But I just want you as the listener to be aware that nothing in this world is for free. Someone is paying for you to listen here for free. And that's me. I'm paying so that you can listen here for nothing. The only way I'm able to produce podcasts is if I have enough work happening in the background to facilitate the time spent to put these episodes together. I have no sponsors. Nobody is hiring me to make these. I make these podcasts because as soon as I can create free materials, I will. I have a YouTube channel for the same reason, but I hardly ever use it or put anything out there because I just don't have the luxury of time to spend making those videos properly for YouTube, even though I want to. I'm hoping to change that in the future. So if you're listening, I want you to know about ways that you can support this podcast, which enables it to continue into the future. The easiest way is to sign up for my Patreon, which I call my video library. I put new content there twice per week, every week, and there is an enormous list of educational materials there already. Very soon, that video library is transforming into a vastly improved platform called the Emotional Horsemanship School, and subscribers to the Patreon will get early bird special access to it very soon. Subscriptions start as little as €5 per month, and you can sign up for 1 month or 12, no pressure. And if you're listening to this episode beyond the year of 2025, the Emotional Horsemanship School is probably already open. So if you wish to support my work on a budget, that is the best way to do it, and you are helping to keep this podcast going. The link for sign up is in the notes of the show below, and you can also go to emotionalhorsemanship.com and navigate to the video library page or the Emotional Horsemanship School page and follow all of the instructions for sign up.
Thank you for supporting my work and allowing me to continue bringing these amazing people to you free to the air. Now, let's return to this episode with hoof care legend, Ida Hammer.
Yeah. Yeah, there's not. So I think this is kind of a cute story from one of my graduates. But there's going to be harder people to get to change off of metal. Like, there's hardcore cowboys and that kind of stuff. But, and I'm not bashing any society or anything like that. But the Amish community is very much into blacksmithery and all this stuff. And so one of my graduates, she has two Amish boys that help her trim her retirement center horses. And she tells them what to do because she's I don't think she's as old as me. So I got to be careful when I say she's older, but she just doesn't have enough to do all of the horses there. So she has the young guys help her. She does hers and she tells them what to do. But their dad's pretty much old school, you know, old school, like
Amish blacksmithing. Yeah.
So she came to class, you know, she was at, because we do the hoof protection class and we go through all different types of ways that we can protect the hooves, doing all different kinds of things.
Lovely.
So I had 3D printed pads with me that go underneath metal shoes. And so, and this is my point, and this is my point to my students as well. It's like, there is no reason. So the metal part is iffy because it's still binding. But I said, there is no reason now with all the things that we have that we do not have support in the caudal region of the foot.
Yes.
So if somebody chooses, that's good English.
If they choose to put on open heel shoes.
They are choosing to damage that horse.
They're like, choosing caudal failure.
Yes.
Eventually.
I can't endorse someone that puts on open heeled metal shoes without supporting the caudal region. I will not endorse them support that decision. So she got a pair of 3D printed shoes and took it to the dad. And he used them. I'm like, I don't know whether he may or may not continue using them, but she planted a seed in a very, very archaic society of beliefs. So in those situations, that's the best that we can do, because you're never going to force somebody to do something. But if you're going to plant a seed that maybe, and I disagree with this whole pattern, but I'm like, but maybe they can get another 500 miles out of their horse because they added that caudal support, that might be something that they'll switch to. I'm like, I don't like the whole thought train of thought, but the horse still wins a bit. It wins
a bit. Yeah. And that's better than nothing at all. So there is still a place for the iron shoe. My other question would be about transitioning from shod to barefoot. It's a fraught situation. Emotions can run high. There's often a lot of financial, entanglement at stake for the owner. There's dreams and aspirations, you know, on the horizon for the owner. There's the horse's welfare at stake. There's professional liability and reputation at stake for the hoof care provider. And there's a question, should they, shouldn't they experience discomfort during that transition? And if they do experience discomfort, or if it is acceptable to experience discomfort, how much and for how long?
So I am pretty adamant. I'm like 99% adamant for clients that are coming out of metal shoes. If they're coming out of metal shoes and they've been in metal shoes, not like they just threw them on for the weekend to go on a trail ride, but if they've been in metal shoes and they come out of metal shoes, I won't pull those shoes unless they let me put composites on.
Got it.
Because it's not fair to the horse. It's like the horse isn't getting any choices in the matter as far as like, I'm wearing metal shoes today and I can't feel part of my feet and my back of my foot hurts. But then now they're going to take the shoes off and then I'm supposed to toughen up. And because what will generally happen is that even if they've had the shoes on and then they take them off, and even if the horse isn't sore footed, that we see sore footed, the chances of them having a compensatory pattern is very, very, very high. Mm. People won't recognize that though, because they're not limping. So they'll say, my horse is fine. And so then your horse is fine until it compensates enough that it's not fine. And then we have a whole nother issue. So they don't get a choice now. I was like, it has to be an extenuating circumstance. But, and some people will say, you know, what about boots? And I'm like, that's a maybe, but people aren't always the best about putting on the boots.
Mm-hmm.
Not 24/7 protection. All a horse has to do is get a little stone bruise and like, then you're set back. So I'm pretty much adamant, like 99% of the time, if I'm taking them out of metal shoes, they've got to go into composites for at least one set.
Mm.
Because several things are starting to happen with that. When you take them out of